Ekhatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekhatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive.
Today, we are plunging into, well, what feels like a whole separate legal dimension, the American system of military justice.
Yeah, it's not just another branch of law, is it? It's like this parallel legal universe.
Yeah.
And it governs over a million service members.
Absolutely. And we're using Eugene R. Fidell's comprehensive work as our map, really.
And what makes this dive so crucial, I think, is this fundamental conflict right at the heart of the system.
That tension.
Exactly. Fidell really grapples with that duality. How does a democratic society run an incredibly effective, you know, disciplined fighting force,
mm-hmm.
while also guaranteeing constitutional rights and due process for everyone who serves?
It's a really fascinating kind of high-stakes system, and it's built on a logic that's pretty alien to civilian life.
Totally.
I mean, think about it. If you're late to your desk job, maybe you get a stern talking to, right? Right? Worst-case scenario.
But if you're late reporting for duty on a combat deployment, well, the consequences can be catastrophic. That massive shift in gravity just changes the whole legal calculation.
Precisely. And understanding this is vital, Fidell argues, for public accountability, for oversight. You know, we can't really debate reform or scrutinize military actions effectively if we don't first grasp the unique structure that governs discipline.
Okay, so before we get into that structure, let's talk about our guide here. Eugene R. Fidell. Who is he, and what gives him this really quite rare perspective on military law?
Well, his authority comes from a really varied career. He's a Yale law grad, started out serving as a judge advocate, that's a military lawyer in the U.S. Coast Guard.
Okay, so he learned the system from the inside out first,
mm-hmm.
understood the culture, the operational needs.
Right, the boots on the ground experience, you could say. But then critically, he moved into being a defense attorney.
Ah, so representing service members.
For decades, navigating courts martial, handling appeals, and then he brought all that practical knowledge into academia, teaching military justice at Yale Law School.
So he's seen it from basically every angle.
Pretty much. And what really seals it is his commitment to reform. He actually co-founded and was president of the National Institute of Military Justice.
In AMJ, yeah.
So the real value here, I think, is that he speaks the language of the officer, the defense lawyer, the academic, and the reformer. That gives the book this, like, three-dimensional authority.
He's seen the system at its best and presumably its worst. So his book, Military Justice, it's designed to sort of demystify this whole thing, make it accessible.
Exactly. Bridging that gap between highly technical law and, you know, general public understanding. And the journey starts, interestingly, with the Constitution itself.
Right. Article I gives Congress the power.
The power to make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces. That's the bedrock. That explicit power is where the whole system gets its teeth.
And the key piece of legislation born from that power is the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the UCMJ, came about in 1950.
Yeah, and that timing is important. It was a direct result of all these complaints about unfairness, inconsistency after World War II.
So it was a reform effort from the start.
It really was. The UCMJ tried to standardize discipline across all the branches, but it immediately kind of codified that core conflict we mentioned. The commander's absolute need for good order and discipline versus the service member's right to fair legal treatment.
And Fidell really hammers this point home, doesn't he? That military justice is a distinct legal system.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just map civilian court standards onto it. You have to recognize the unique structure, especially that commander's role, which is, well, there's always the flashpoint in public debates.
Absolutely. And the book guides us through that whole structure, from the specific crimes under the UCMJ to the different levels of trials, the appeals process, and then it tackles the big contemporary issues like sexual assault and command influence.
Okay, let's dig into the UCMJ itself. It has these punitive articles, 77 through 134, defining offenses. What does Fidell highlight as particularly unique or essential there, especially Article 134?
Well, sure. You have offenses like desertion or insubordination, obviously unique to the military context. But the real sort of flexible power often lies in Article 134. That's the general article.
The catch-all.
Basically, yeah. It covers conduct that brings discredit upon the armed forces. So it can criminalize things like conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman, or even just vague disorders and neglect that harm the military community's standing or function.
So it's not just about specific illegal actions, but about behavior that might erode trust or readiness within the unit.
Exactly. The idea is the code needs to be broader because the stakes, unit cohesion, mission success are just so much higher. Okay, so shifting to the judicial structure. The military has this tiered system of courts-martial, kind of parallels civilian courts in seriousness, but what makes that lowest level distinct?
Right, the three tiers define the severity and potential punishment. At the bottom, you have the summary court-martial. This is really for minor stuff.
Mm.
It's presided over by just a single officer.
Okay.
And, crucially, the accused usually doesn't get a defense lawyer provided, though they can refuse the summary court-martial and demand a higher-level trial where they would get counsel.
Interesting. Okay, so step up from that.
Then you get the special court-martial. This is the intermediate level. Think maybe analogous to a civilian misdemeanor court, but potentially with more serious consequences.
How serious?
It can impose up to 1 year of confinement. But this is where the stakes really jump, because it can also impose a bad conduct discharge, a BCD.
Okay, BCD, that sounds serious, but what's the actual practical impact? You mentioned a lifelong stigma.
Oh, it's huge.
Yeah.
A BCD is essentially a felony level mark on your permanent record. It's punitive, issued by the court-martial. And critically, it usually strips the service member of almost all veterans' benefits.
Wow. Like the GI Bill.
Yeah.
Healthcare.
Gone. In most cases. And think about applying for civilian jobs with that on your record. It creates major hurdles.
Okay, so yeah, that definitely puts the special court-martial in the high-stakes category, even if it's not the highest court.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then at the top, you have the general court-martial. This is the felony equivalent in the military system.
Right.
It can try any offense under the UCMJ, no matter how serious.
That's...
And it can impose the highest penalties, life imprisonment, even capital punishment, though that's extremely rare these days.
And this brings us squarely to that point of contention. Fidel highlights the unique power of command.
Hmm. The convening authority.
Right. Unlike the civilian world, where police, prosecutors, judges, they're all separate entities. In the military, the commanding officer, the COTO, the same person responsible for the mission's success, holds this judicial power as the convening authority.
That's the key difference, isn't it? The commander is sort of the chief administrator of justice for their unit.
They decide whether to press charges in the first place. They select the members of the court-martial panel, that's the military jury. And historically, they had just immense influence over the whole process.
That dual role leader and judicial gatekeeper seems like the biggest challenge to impartiality.
It is. It's the structural heart of the debate. But to try and balance that power, the system does have key procedural protections built in. Like, for serious charges headed to a general court-martial, there's the Article 32 preliminary hearing.
Okay, Article 32. We often hear it compared to a civilian grand jury. But you said it's different, maybe even more robust for the defense.
The comparison is okay as a starting point, but yeah, it's misleading in a key way. Unlike a civilian grand jury, where the defense lawyer is usually locked out.
Right, it's just the prosecutor presenting.
In an Article 32 hearing, the defense team has the right to be there to present their own evidence, and this is huge to cross-examine the government's witnesses.
Wow, okay, so the defense gets an early look and a chance to directly challenge the evidence.
Exactly. It's a significant discovery tool and a real due process protection right near the start.
That is a big difference. Now, what about the panel itself, the military jury? You mentioned they're selected by the commander and they have to be senior in rank to the accused. Does that create its own pressures?
It certainly changes the dynamic. The panel members are usually officers or senior NCOs, deeply embedded in the military culture and hierarchy. That's undeniable. However, the appellate system provides a really significant counterbalance.
Okay, how so?
Well, first, after a conviction and sentence, the convening authority the commander has to review and approve it. They have the power to reduce the sentence, they can show leniency, but crucially, they can never increase it. That's the first check.
Okay, so they can lessen the blow but not make it worse, and then appeals, where do they go?
Appeals go up through the specific service courts of Criminal Appeals Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Air Force, Coast Guard, but the final really critical stop within the military system is the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, or CAAF.
All right, CAA,
huh?
The highest military court. But wait, you mentioned something surprising earlier. It's staffed entirely by civilians.
That's right. Five civilian judges appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, just like federal judges. This is the main integration point with the broader federal judiciary.
That seems like a massive intentional check on the military system itself.
It absolutely is. Because CAAF is staffed by civilian jurists applying constitutional law and precedent, Their decisions can, in some cases, even be appealed further, all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. So it fully plugs military justice into the federal system at the top.
Okay, this brings us right back to the challenge of reform, especially around the sexual assault crisis. When the system fails, Fidel suggests it often comes down to unlawful command influence, or UCI. Can you maybe give a quick, sort of anonymized example of how UCI actually works? Why is it so damaging and hard to prove?
Sure. UCI is basically when a commander improperly uses their rank or position to influence any part of the judicial process, the decision to charge, who sits on the panel, witness testimony, the sentence. A common, really insidious example is subtle pressure.
Not a direct order, but...
Exactly. A commander might casually say to a potential panel member, you know, we really need to send a strong message about this kind of misconduct. Or maybe they express subtle disapproval if charges are dropped against someone they think is guilty. That creates a chilling effect. People worry about their careers.
That soft pressure coming from the person who literally controls your assignments, your promotions. Yeah, that's incredibly potent.
And that's why Fidel calls UCI the mortal enemy of military justice. The crisis around sexual assault prosecutions was fueled in large part by the perception and often the reality that commanders were sometimes biased or perhaps too protective of accused members or just mishandling cases. UCI was seen as a core structural problem.
Which led directly to that landmark 2021 reform, right? That was huge news.
Absolutely historic. It stripped commanders of the authority to decide whether to prosecute sexual assault and several other serious crimes. That power was transferred to new, independent special trial counsel, lawyers outside the chain of command.
A direct response to that fundamental conflict, the leader also being the judicial administrator.
Precisely. A massive shift aimed at improving impartiality for those specific serious offenses.
Okay, so stepping back from the mechanics, Fidel's work seems less about just listing rules and more about defining this ongoing, well, tension. The first big theme feels like tension, not choice.
That really is the core thesis, isn't it? Military justice is caught in this constant fundamental push and pull. It has to serve military necessity and constitutional rights. And the challenge, Fidel says, isn't choosing one over the other.
You can't just pick one.
Right. You can't just apply pure civilian law to a battlefield or a deployed unit. The challenge is finding ways to serve both masters simultaneously.
Okay. And the second theme tackles that controversial command role. Commander authority must be channeled.
Yeah. Command influence, in the sense of enforcing discipline and standards, is absolutely necessary for a functioning military,
right,
especially in high-stress situations. So Fidel argues the goal of reform shouldn't be to eliminate the commander's disciplinary role entirely.
They still need to lead the unit.
Of course. The goal is to channel that authority properly, to strictly define and regulate where their command influence is appropriate and necessary, and where it absolutely must end to ensure due process and impartiality kick in. Like with the special trial counsel reform.
Right. And the final theme looks at the bigger picture, the long view, the story of civilianization.
Mm-hmm. Over the last, 70 plus years since the UCMJ, the system has undeniably moved steadily towards greater due process rights, more constitutional protections, more alignment with civilian standards in many ways.
But that evolution wasn't necessarily driven from within the military.
Often not. Fidel points out it was frequently driven by external pressure, scrutiny from Congress, landmark court decisions, public outrage over scandals, whether it was post-WWII issues, Vietnam-era controversies, or the recent sexual assault crisis. That external pressure is often the key driver of institutional change.
That's a really important insight. Okay, Fidel also has some really clear, powerful ways of stating things. He cuts through the complexity. For example, capturing that core thesis, military justice must serve two masters, military effectiveness and constitutional fairness. And the challenge lies not in choosing between them, but in serving both.
That line just perfectly encapsulates the whole dilemma, doesn't it? It's not military effectiveness or fairness. It's how do you achieve both at the same time?
And then there's his take on the command structure, which avoids easy answers. The role of command in military justice is not an anachronism to be eliminated, but a reality to be properly channeled.
Yeah, that reflects his nuanced view. He's not saying tear it all down. He's saying you have to acknowledge the reality of command, but refine the system, particularly by curbing unlawful command influence while preserving necessary disciplinary tools.
And one more, on accountability and trust, which feels vital. A military justice system that loses the confidence of service members undermines both military discipline and democratic values.
Mm-hmm. That highlights the dual accountability, right? The system has to work for the troops subject to it, and it has to maintain the confidence of the public it serves and protects. Lose either, and the whole thing is weakened.
So thinking about practical applications, how does understanding all this help, say, an informed citizen?
Well, for informed citizens, having this framework helps you cut through the noise, right? When news breaks about a military scandal or there's a debate in Congress about UCMJ reform, you can analyze it based on some understanding of the actual system, not just headlines or emotion. It enables more effective democratic oversight.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And what about for service members themselves? This must be incredibly empowering knowledge.
Oh, absolutely. For anyone subject to the UCMJ, understanding the difference between, say, a special and a general court-martial, knowing their rights during an Article 32 hearing, knowing that there are robust appeal avenues, that knowledge is a critical safeguard. It helps them navigate the system if they ever face disciplinary action.
And finally, for policymakers, what's the takeaway for them?
For policymakers, Fidel's approach offers really crucial criteria. When considering any reform, you have to constantly ask, does this change strengthen due process? And does it do so without unduly harming military effectiveness and readiness? He provides a framework for crafting laws that actually serve both the institution and the individual.
What really stands out to me, wrapping up, is that core idea that the system's unique logic is fundamentally driven by military readiness. That concept is just so different from civilian life.
It really is.
And understanding why things like, say, insubordination are treated so seriously helps you appreciate why some differences between military and civilian law are legitimate, maybe even necessary, while other aspects, like the historical reach of command influence in prosecuting serious crimes, clearly needed the urgent reform we've seen.
Yeah, my final thought is kind of similar. The military justice system isn't static. It's this living, breathing reflection of how our democracy tries to balance security and liberty. It's constantly in flux, being pushed and pulled by societal changes, by new challenges like the sexual assault crisis, by technology even. Fidel gives us the map, but the territory itself is always evolving. The complexity really is the truth of it. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.